You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Hello and welcome into the sixth episode of the Last Word on Sports College Football Podcast. My name is Austin Craycraft, and today I'm joined by staff writer Yesh Ginsberg. How are we doing, Yesh?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. We just finished week two of the college football season. Coming into it, we were kind of underwhelmed after such an exciting week one. How did week two live up to your expectations?
Let's be honest. College football almost never disappoints, right? There are always, we get a slate of up to 80 games a week, right? So if instead of having 15 great ones all ending close to the same time and shuffling between channels, so if we only get four or five, like, that's never a bad thing. Week one had a lot of high-profile games, was very hyped, and a lot of those games provided awesome results. It also helped that the Sunday and Monday night games did not disappoint, because otherwise it feels like it does. But they were spread out. It was good on week one. Week two, we had crazy endings. We had games that, if you pay attention to the whole country, you know, kept you riveted. And if you're only interested in the top 10, so those were, for the most part, not as exciting. But there's still plenty to watch. There was never a reason to walk away from your television. So I can't say I'm ever disappointed in week two.
Right. And we still have that feeling of college football is back alive, so you can't really complain, no matter what the quality of the slate is.
Right.
As we get started here, let's start with an interesting football game, to say the least. Central Michigan took down Oklahoma State in Stillwater in what was pretty dramatic fashion. You probably heard about it, but if not, let me give you a quick recap. So Oklahoma State led 27-24 with 4 seconds left, and it was fourth down. And Oklahoma State was unsure of what to do, so Mason Rudolph, they decided just to huck it up out of bounds. But there were no receivers in the area, and they probably didn't think of this, but it ended in an intentional grounding penalty, although the repercussions of it were not what they thought they would be. The rule book says that a period shall be extended for an untimed down if a penalty is accepted for a live ball foul. But the exception that the MAC refs were unaware of, along with the Big 12 replay officials were unaware of, was that the period is not extended if the foul is by the team in possession and the statement of the penalty includes loss of down. So in short, the game was ended, but then they came back on and gave Central Michigan one untimed down. And in that untimed down, one of the more incredible plays happened in recent memory, where Cooper Rush dropped back, threw the Hail Mary to Jesse Kroll, who was being tackled at the 12, pitches it back to Corey Willis, who dove for the pylon and scored and ended up giving the Chippewas the win. But I don't think the play is quite as big of a story as the rule interpretation. What were your thoughts on the whole situation, and what do you think of all this madness?
Well, first of all, rules and mistakes happen all the time. They happen often enough, and they're bad. This one, I caught it immediately. I noticed it immediately. As soon as I get to watch the game live. I had to watch a replay, but I hadn't heard about it yet. So watching the replay, I saw the play live. I knew the rule. I am a bit of a nerd and enjoy reading rule books of many different sports. So I knew the rule. I knew the refs got it wrong. I was actually curious as to whether the replay booth had the authority to overrule this, because it's not technically an egregious clock error. It's a referee's applying a penalty rule error. So they punished the Big 12 replay crew. I haven't seen anywhere where the Big 12 replay crew gave a statement as to why they didn't correct it. It could be they thought that was not within their authority. The rule is bad. It's bad they missed the rule. There's nothing you can do to change it, right? They played another play. The game is final. You can't go back and change it. Bill Hancock, the president, the head of the college football playoff, mentioned that this is why it's good to have a committee, because, you know, they can know what happened. but I highly doubt they'll treat this like an Oklahoma State win. Even if they do, a 3-point win over Central Michigan, who's an interesting and impressive team. They line up very well when they meet bigger schools. They played Oklahoma State close last year also. So, being up by 3 on a MAC school, probably who won't win the MAC, but a decent 8-9-1 MAC school is not the best position for a top 25 team to be anyway. So I don't see any drastic actions taken by the playoff selection committee when the time comes to it as rewarding Oklahoma State with a win here. I thought that it's logical that if the game should have been over, it's not like you had to redo a play or anything. The game should have been over, that maybe there should be a way to change it. But, these things happen. We saw Miami Duke last year, which was just as egregious, several mistakes there on the last play of the game that should have ended the game. These things happen, and it's horrible for the teams they happen to, but, as long as you have human officials, there's no real way to avoid it. They will happen, and hopefully when they happen, it doesn't have as big an effect as it did in this game. So, Oklahoma State had a chance to stop Central Michigan after. They could have put this game away throughout much of it. This could have been a blowout in the first half. Oklahoma State did not play their best game. So, at the end of the day, it changed who won and who lost, but it's not like it changed how we would view these two teams, because the game shouldn't have been in that position anyway from Oklahoma State's perspective.
Yeah. The one thing that I want to key on that you said is the comparison to the Miami Duke game of last year, in which they missed plenty of calls, just as they missed in this one. Do you think that since they are the clock is ended and there is no possible chance for either team to do anything to screw it up, do you think the other team should be rewarded a victory if they find a refereeing error?
I mean, that's such an awful precedent to set, right? There's so many ways that could go wrong. Even if in this case, it's hard to think of something that that would change that, because it was the last play and the game should have been declared over. But, it's such a bad precedent to set, even though this seems to be a clear line, if the clock hits zero and there was a mistake. But then what if next time, there's a judgment call penalty that was really too bad? Right? Think back to what everyone still yells about. I'm a Buckeye fan. I hear this all the time. 2002 National Championship game. What if they decided that penalty was, the famous pass interference in the end zone?
Uh-huh.
Right. What if you decided that penalty was called wrong, so the game should have been over there? Right? If you play another play afterward, in some ways I think Miami Duke is easier to talk about overturning because that was the last play of the game. Nothing else happened after, right? It's like when you're playing baseball under protest, right? Nothing else happened after. There was nothing that came after that we would have to redo or think about redoing. It was actually the last play of the game. This, you play it after, and even if in this case it makes sense, it's such a difficult precedent to set to think about doing. So I hope the refs don't make mistakes in the first place. We should make sure that the referees know what they're doing. But I think it's very difficult to try and start overturning outcomes after the fact.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And just in the football game in general, like you said, Oklahoma State, they should have been able to just come out with the win in easier fashion. Mason Rudolph's a quality quarterback, and he should be able to lead that team to victory. And I know it was upset, and so were Cowboy fans across the country, but they had their chance to win this game. They could have made the play on the last play. There's 100 other plays in the game that they could have played differently and could have changed the outcome, but this is how the cards fell, and it sucks for fans in Stillwater, but this is the way it has to go.
Right. Before we end talking about this game, I just want to point out, just people don't realize, Cooper Rush has done this before. Right? This is his second in the Bahamas Bowl 2 years ago. That play was even more incredible than this one, although the same basic concept, right? Deep pass, late lateral. Right? It's a very interesting variation on a lot of teams who they don't have a quarterback that would have the arm to get to the end zone for a true Hail Mary, which try the short hook and lateral, right, where you go over the middle and try and, develop a play downfield. This is an interesting wrinkle on that, which has worked twice for Central Michigan now in the last 3 years. So it's probably something that coaches and other people around the country are going to be looking at as to, how effective this play is for late-game situations, because, at least for Central Michigan, it seems to work.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and it has worked out super well for the Chippewas. As we transition out of this one, we move to an interesting football game, Penn State versus Pitt. Pitt takes the victory 42-39 at Heinz Field in Pittsburgh, in the most attended sporting event in Pittsburgh's history. For Pitt, they were led by James Conner. They had a chance to actually end up losing this game, but the Penn State quarterback, Trace McSorley, threw an interception from the 31-yard line to kind of seal the Nittany Lions' fate. Despite what the heroics, Saquon Barkley throughout the game with 5 touchdowns, mounting a comeback effort in which they were down 28-7 at half. What did you think of the Battle of Pennsylvania?
Well, I'm going to be honest. Penn State, I've not been the biggest fan of Penn State under James Franklin. He recruits well. I haven't seen them really put out a good product on the field in the past few years. This game impressed me because I am a fan. I'm a big believer in Pat Narduzzi and what he does with defenses. I think Pitt's defense last year looked very good. I have no reason to think it'd be worse this year. And I was just impressed a lot of the ways that Penn State managed to move the ball through this game. Pitt's defense is good. Pitt clearly had a very dominant game plan to start. Penn State did well to not give up and fight and come back. And Penn State really impressed me with that. McSorley, aside from, I think it was probably, maybe I missed one or two earlier in the game, it was probably the only really bad decision McSorley made. Was the interception at the end. McSorley played a very good game. The receivers managed to find spots in the secondary. He made good quality throws for much of the game. There was a drop, I think, a few plays or a series earlier that could have made a huge difference. I was very impressed by Penn State in the offense. And from this game, I always knew I was going to be a contender in the ACC, certainly because they're not in the same division as Clemson, Florida State, and even Louisville. So they're going to have a good chance at the ACC title game, and once you get there, anything can happen. But I think Penn State, they're not going to win the Big Ten. But Ohio State, Michigan, and Michigan State, if they're watching this game, are going to be on a bit of alert, especially Michigan State, who knows very well, right? Mark Antonio knows very well how good Pat Narduzzi's coaching defense is. And if Penn State can put up 39 on Narduzzi's defense, so Michigan State's going to be on alert for this game for sure.
Yeah, and I actually came out with a little bit more of a concern for Pittsburgh's defense because I did think they were very good coming in this year. But do you think that's more of a token of Penn State's offense more than a detriment of Pitt's defense?
So I don't know. It could be either, right? We have to see more games to really know. I have not had a chance, you do real film study and see how receivers got open and see how it worked. Because Pitt's defense did look they look fine to open the season. I wasn't against any good competition, but they look fine to open the season. So I don't know. I mean, as of now, it could be either one of those two things. I trust Narduzzi, so I tend to be leaning towards my way of taking it. But after the next week or two, I could definitely come around to the way you're seeing it, just seeing how they play in the future.
Well, yeah, I actually do think that Pitt's defense is pretty good, but I was just surprised to see them give up this sort of effort. But I don't think they'll find many more running backs across their schedule but as good as Saquon Barkley, who made them.
I agree with that.
Not look too great. And I guess McSorley did have 332 yards and only that one mistake. So he did play one of his better games, and he's growing and learning after his first start. Any other takeaways from this game?
Not much in particular. Nothing major to point out. I just looked at the schedule. Pitt plays Oklahoma State and North Carolina in the next 2 weeks. So I guess after those 2 weeks, I'll be able to rejudge Penn State's offense, depending on how Pitt does against those two squads. They both have very capable offenses.
Right. We did learn that Pitt still just loves that running game. Nathan Peterman only throwing those 15 passes. So it'll be interesting to see if they can, whether they can slow the pace down against those up-tempo offenses of Oklahoma State and North Carolina, or whether they are able to control it. We move on to one of the many great night games we had on Saturday night, Arkansas against TCU. Arkansas comes into Fort Worth and takes down the Horned Frogs, 41-38 in double overtime. The first kind of talk about before we get to any Razorback players is the TCU do-it-all receiver. He dazzled all night long and burst onto the college football scene with 126 receiving yards along with multiple explosive returns. He was really the spark of offense for the Horned Frogs the entire night, along with Kenny Hill playing kind of the exact way you expect Kenny Hill to play in this sort of game. And for Arkansas, they lean on their ground game just like every Brett Bielema-led team does with Raleigh Williams. What were your takeaways from this thriller?
So I was honestly down on both these teams coming into this game. I thought they both really disappointed in week one. And the game was exciting, but I don't think it was. I don't think it showed good things about either team. It definitely showed they both have talent and are capable of doing great things. Right? TCU was their offense did not a lot of mistakes, a lot of problems for most of the game. The fourth quarter they came alive, and it was really exciting then. And if they played that way for four quarters, this would have been a blowout. And their game against South Dakota State last week would have been a blowout. So for all the stats they managed to rack up, for all the great plays Kenny Hill's managed to make, their offense was not consistent at all this week. The defense has serious problems. They showed they came up big in the fourth quarter until the last drive, which they gave up. But they had a big fourth quarter. But other than that, defense had problems. So TCU definitely has individual playmakers. So Arkansas has gotten better each of the last 2 years of the season's gone on under Brett Bielema. They definitely played better this week than last week. So I think Arkansas just played their style, right? They've got Bielema definitely brought a bit of his style from Wisconsin with him. They play their game. They have big linemen. They have a strong running game. They play the game to their speed, whatever they choose it to be. And they play the game well, and they get better as the season goes on. So I'm not so concerned about Arkansas. I mean, they're in the SEC West, and that's always tough. The SEC West might have more question marks this year, so maybe Arkansas can work a little higher. TCU, I think, has got big problems. I think it's the worst defense I've ever seen TCU have under Gary Patterson. I came out last week with major concerns about TCU. But Arkansas looks solid moving forward.
Yeah, and you come into the season hearing about how Gary Patterson might have his defense back on the rise and how that might be the strength of the defense if they lost so many offensive playmakers from a season ago. But that does not look like it's the case. They'll just go as far as their offense takes them. And for Arkansas, one last point, I was very impressed, maybe not very, I was impressed by Austin Allen, Brandon Allen's brother. He made the plays that he needed to. He wasn't spectacular, but he just needed to do what needed to be done, and that impressed me. Any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, and sure. I agree with what you said about Allen. I think that makes him Brett Bielema's perfect quarterback. He's not looking for guys to take over games. He's looking for guys to manage his style and beat people with the offensive line in the running game.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I think it's very good.
And he has a few more weapons than the Razorbacks are typically accustomed to in the receiving corps with Drew Morgan and Keon Hatcher coming up with big plays down the stretch. Let's move on to the battle at Bristol. It came and went. One of the most highly publicized games in recent memory. The record crowd, of course, demolished the all-time college football attendance record by about 40,000 or so at Bristol. But on the field, Tennessee, they established averaging 5.2 yards per carry, led by Josh Dobbs and Jalen Hurd. And that limited Dobbs to just 19 pass attempts, which I tend to think is a good thing, because I believe that the more you give Dobbs the ball, the more mistakes he is prone to make. And for the Hokies, they just didn't play with much composure. 5 lost fumbles, 8 ill-timed penalties, leading to 101 yards. On the positives for the Hokies going forward, I was impressed with the duo of Gerard Evans and Trayvon McMillan, and I do think that this team has a higher upside than I first thought, but they weren't able to come up with the victory this week. What were your thoughts? Are you there?
Yeah, you there? I didn't hear you for the last 5 seconds, so.
Okay. What were your thoughts on this game?
Okay. Well, first of all, I thought Tennessee started out very slow. It was right. We saw them show against Appalachian State and really get beat in the trenches in that game, which was very surprising. They started out slow this game, which was reinforcing all the ideas a lot of us had, and then, I don't know, it was just like the team flipped the switch, right? I think Virginia Tech got a fumble early when they were 14-0, and after that it was all Tennessee. And it was just like Tennessee changed to a different team, the team that, you know, the team that got them put in the top 10 to start the season that lots of people were looking forward to seeing. I thought Tennessee looked very good. The offense looked unstoppable. From the second quarter onwards, defense looked tough and nasty. Virginia Tech has problems with lost fumbles, but they had problems last week also. But Tennessee did not make things easy for them on offense at all. I don't know where Virginia Tech's going from here. I learned the past few years to trust Fuente as the coach at Memphis. But Virginia Tech, once after they took that 14-0 lead, they didn't look so good. And a lot of that was how dominant Tennessee played. So I can't, you know, make a good judgment on them just from this. But I came out of this game very impressed with Tennessee. If they play like the way they played, you know, from the second quarter onward, if they play like the way they played in their first game in the first quarter, you could see them almost lose to Ohio next week. So Ohio is very similar to Appalachian State, actually. So it depends which Tennessee team shows up. We saw a top 10. We saw a Tennessee team that shouldn't belong in the top 25 start the game. We saw a top 10 team finish it. So Tennessee definitely has the potential, and I hope that we can see them live up to it in future games.
Yeah, they certainly exploded in that second quarter, outscoring them 24-0, 10-point lead, going into half, and they never looked back. The Volunteers, like you said, have been very volatile the last 2 weeks. You've seen the best and the worst, so it'll be interesting to see what we get out of them going forward. What are your expectations for these two teams going forward? Because Tennessee came in, as you said, as a top 10 team. They dropped, and this week they showed their flashes. What do you see out of them, and do you think Virginia Tech can be a competitor in their ACC division?
I don't quite think Virginia Tech is where they can compete in the ACC. I mean, I think they're well behind. Maybe they can compete in one of the games. I think they're right now well behind Pitt and North Carolina. In the Coastal, so I think that's going to be tough. Miami also, maybe Miami's in there. So I don't know if Virginia Tech is quite, at least for this season, going to be able to compete for the top of the Coastal division at all. They have a tough schedule. Making a bowl game might be tough, right? They still have non-conference games against Notre Dame and ECU left. ECU beat NC State this week. ECU's a good team. So I think Virginia Tech's season should be talking about bowl eligibility much more than it should be talking about, you know, competing for the ACC. Tennessee, if they play like they played in the last three quarters this week, they could beat anyone. Their game against Alabama will be fun. If they play like they played last week, they're going to lose to a lot of SEC teams. They actually have a relatively soft SEC schedule as SEC schedules go. They're in the East, and their cross-divisional games are against Alabama and Texas A&M. Texas A&M is a bit of an unknown so far this year. We haven't seen we've seen a bit out of them. They look good against UCLA. So Tennessee will definitely be in play. If they play this week, they'll definitely be in play for the East. And we'll see how well they can compete, you know, nationally when they go up against Alabama in October.
Yeah, this Volunteer team certainly has to be one of the five to watch in terms of what you're going to get going forward, because they could be anywhere from top 5 to outside the top 25. Let's move westward a little bit for the Holy War, and I just want to say that this one was a strange one, to say the least. 9 combined turnovers, 6 of them were by the winning team, Utes, 20-19, and they still managed to win the possession battle by 6 minutes. BYU took their chance to win this one. They scored in the last minute. And they decided to go for 2 to win the game. It did not end up working out, unlike you saw the Raiders yesterday use that strategy on the road and win the game. What are your thoughts on Kalani Sitake and his staff's choice to go for 2 in that final minute?
Well, I'm a big stats guy. I think a coach's job is to make a choice that maximizes team's chances of winning. And statistically, it's almost never the right move to go for two in that situation. It's the right move when you're a major underdog in actual play. But in overtime, you have a, especially if you have a, I mean, mistakes being made, you have a, but if the teams are equal, if you're a slight favorite, you have a better than 50% chance of winning in overtime. Going for two in college, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's successful a little less than 50% of the time. So statistically, it's almost never worth it. Here there's some time left on the clock, so maybe that helps the statistics a little, because if you tie, so Utah gets a chance. If you take the lead, Utah also gets a chance, right? So it's hard to run real numbers, but it's almost never the right choice statistically. And I thought this team was outplaying Utah. Utah had the long drive right before, but BYU looked good for most of the game. I think in the short yard situation of college overtime, I think BYU had a chance. Utah has the advantage with the better kicker, with Mr. Automatic. But really, I think it was a mistake, and not just because it didn't work out. Right? This isn't Boise State, Oklahoma, where you're getting beaten down and you need to either end the game now on your own terms. I think it shows a lack of faith in his team's ability to win an even match in overtime, and I don't like the call at all.
I kind of like it if you're on the road and it's a rivalry game like that, but it sounds like you've seen the numbers on it and the numbers say otherwise. So
it's not significantly worse usually if teams are really even, but it's really not the best play, and I didn't like it here.
Yeah, and as you said, if the teams are even, it makes a lot of sense to just take the points and take your chances in overtime. Just other takeaways throughout this game. I'm glad Taysom Hill has stayed healthy for two straight games now. He accounted for 176 passing yards, 87 rushing yards, two touchdowns on the ground, and three interceptions. And for Utah, they were able to gain some yards through the air and on the ground, but they just kept turning it over. But I still don't understand how BYU wasn't able to put the ball in the end zone more often throughout this game, because six turnovers is just abysmal. And I think Utah's defense just came alive when it needed to with that dominant defensive front. What else stood out to you in this one?
Right. That really was, if you think about it, it was an ugly football game, just from a pure football perspective. There were lots of bad plays, lots of mistakes made, lots of turnovers, and I think that speaks a little to the nature of this rivalry. I was talking to someone about rivalry in college football. I once described, in general, most college football rivalries, you have a respectful hatred for one another, right? You see when Molly Carr's, I think, grandson had cancer, so Ohio State and Michigan, right? Definitely one of the top two or three most hateful rivalries of college football. Right, you know, they come together, they do things for each other, right? There's a bit of respect in there with that comes out at times with the hatred. Utah BYU is just different, right? There's a reason they call it the Holy War. It's almost religious in its nature. So it just comes out very differently, and I think that showed itself on the football field, that this wasn't, you know, two teams who really don't like each other inspiring each other to play better. This was just a tough fight out there, and teams made mistakes because of it.
Yeah, and this one had been played recently, as it happened last year in the Las Vegas Bowl, which is pretty crazy, but it's a fun one to be just still happening, as we've seen some rivalries kind of disappear over the years, and this one, they still kind of bring the hatred toward each other. And now as we move on to the later portion of the night, we move on to Pac-12 After Dark. We had a lot of fun games in this late slate. Hopefully you guys were able to stay up for them. Arizona State was able to best Texas Tech 68-55 behind Kalen Ballage's record-tying eight touchdowns. Oregon was led by Royce Freeman with an over 200-yard rushing game as they beat Virginia 44-26. Washington State lost to Boise State after losing to Eastern Washington last week on the Smurf Turf, 31-28. San Diego State, led by Donnell Pumphrey, ran all over Cal to beat them 45-40. And Arizona, they were just barely able to squeak out over Grambling, 31-21 with the Grambling band there. So you can just kind of take this one wherever you want, whichever those games kind of interest you, go for it.
Well, first of all, I love the hashtag, Pac-12 After Dark. I'm glad you mentioned it. It's just and so much fun. It fits the games perfectly. It's so much fun to watch the games. These games are always seem to always be crazy every week if you stay up for them. So I think, I don't know, Arizona State, Texas Tech, honestly, it was a shootout. There was no defense played in that game, and it kind of bored me. I mean, it was a great game. It was a lot of fun, but, like, if I want to watch a track meet, I'll watch track, you know? Football, dude, you got to play defense, and both these teams have tremendous offenses and no defense, and, well, we got that's what we got out of it. We got records set on offense.
Let me interrupt you real quick. One note on that game that I noticed. Texas Tech's quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, I realized that he kind of got rattled when the pressure was coming, and Arizona State brought plenty of it as the night wore on. So it'll just be interesting to see if that continues to bother him as they go into Big 12 play. Continue, though. Sorry.
Right. Actually, it was interesting because I thought Mahomes did very well under pressure last year, so it was interesting to see here. That's a good thing you point out. I'll jump from there to Washington State, Boise State. These are two pretty good teams, actually. Very impressive. Even Washington State, they lost to Eastern Washington in their first game. They did the same. They lost, I think it was Portland State or Sacramento State last year. I have to look
Portland
which
State,
one.
Yeah.
Portland State. They lost to Portland State last year over the season, still won 9 games. They were competitive in the Pac-12 North, so they could do the same this year. Boise looks like a talented team this year. They made a lot. They were a talented team last year, lost a lot of games. They made tons of mistakes. Brett Rippon looks like a great quarterback of the future. Needs better decision making sometimes, but he's clearly a talented passer, probably the most talented passer Boise's had. We could let him argue that with Kellen Moore. Boise State looks like a good team. Washington State fought tough there, so I think that looks good for both of them moving forward. Boise State's schedule looks good from here for them to be able to possibly be able to win out from here. Oregon State, that's a game they should win. And BYU is the other tough one, and then they'll get to if they manage to do well, so they'll probably see San Diego State, who also just beat a Pac-12 team this week. They beat Cal, and that could be a fun Mountain West championship game. I'm sure the Mountain West is looking at those two teams and hoping they can both get through this season at 12-0, because then they'll have a very high profile championship game for the whole country to watch. San Diego State, well, I mentioned them. I've been saying for somehow the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, they seem to manage to always have great running backs. I don't know what they do at that school that they get such good running backs, but I've been calling Donnell Pumphrey the best running back no one's ever heard of since last year. He looked awesome this week. Like, there's no way to say it. He broke Marshall Faulk's career yardage record, which is just crazy when you think about it. So, those both look like very good teams. You know, when everyone talks about the Group of Five and I mean, neither of these teams are getting in the playoffs, but talking about potential playoff busters or New Year's Six games or whatever, everyone's looking at the American with Houston. But Boise State and San Diego State are two very good teams, and they're on a collision course for what should be an excellent MAC championship game. It's dumb to look 3 months in the future, but there's no one else in the MAC who's really in the Mountain West. I said the MAC. I'm in the Mountain West. In the Mountain West, who's really on their level this year. So I'm looking forward to that. It should be a fun one, unless something gets in the way.
Yeah. Those two teams, I think, are probably, off the top of my head, I think they're probably number two and number three in terms of Group of Five teams in the country. Do you want to say anything about the Arizona Grambling State game?
You know, I didn't watch it at all. I looked from the stats, and I was just shocked at Arizona. I saw a description on Twitter of Arizona getting being beaten in the trenches by Grambling, which doesn't make any sense at all. Like, that just shouldn't happen to a Group of Five team, no matter how bad you are. So I don't know what the story with that is, but Arizona came back and won, but they were getting destroyed early, and that just does not look good for Arizona and Coach Richard Rodriguez. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched the game.
I saw bits and pieces because I was kind of flipping it on in the background, but because I had other rooting interests going on, but. Yeah, and Arizona's coming off that loss to BYU last week, so it's not looking great. This was a year that the Pac-12 South was kind of up for grabs, but It does not look like Arizona is going to be the team to kind of go up there and grab it. Any final thoughts on this Pac-12 night?
No, we didn't mention Oregon, but Virginia's not such a good team, so it's hard to really judge them. The offense looks explosive as always. The defense, I still have some questions, so we'll have to wait for them to until they get into tougher competition to really judge them. I think that's good coverage of the Pac-12 for this week.
Yeah, and Oregon you'll get that test next week as they go into Lincoln to face Nebraska.
Nebraska, right.
That should be a fun one, and I do have those questions about the Brady Hoke defense, and they might get answered. We'll see. We'll see if Nebraska is able to take advantage of Brady Hoke's 3-4 and his defensive tackles and defensive ends having about 4-yard splits in between them so they can just run it down their throat. But I'm rambling, so I'm going to stop before I get very angry. Now let's go through some quick hitters throughout the weekend. What did you think of the Georgia and Clemson scares? Georgia just barely beating out Nicholls State in what was a fairly entertaining game, and then Clemson besting Troy 30-24.
Well, good teams, if you're going to drop a game and still want to be in the playoff conversation, you're entitled to, I think, one bad game that you survive, but not so much more than that. If you're on the table, it doesn't matter how badly you do it, if you're in a power conference. So they're still undefeated if they drop a game and look unimpressive in future ones, so this will come back to haunt them. Clemson twice already. They made a lot of mistakes against Auburn. They made a lot of mistakes against Troy. They have not. The talent's clearly there. They just haven't put it out on the field yet. So Clemson's a bit of an enigma. But they'll have their chances. They'll have their chance to get beaten against Louisville, Florida State, maybe another game or two in the ACC. And, you know, if they manage to run the table, so no one will care about this game. If they struggle against a few other bad teams and drop one along the way, so then there'll be a conversation about how much they belong. And the same with Georgia. Georgia's a little safer being in the SEC. If you get through the SEC with one loss, you're pretty safe also. So, like, but if they keep on struggling, and they look great. Georgia's looked great against North Carolina for most of the game. So that was much more shocking, actually. That Nicholls came that close. That's much more shocking than the Clemson scare. But right, so one, you survive, you move on. If they do it a few more times, so then we'll have to wonder whether they're as good as we thought they were.
Yeah, and Deshaun Watson through these first 2 weeks hasn't looked quite like himself. As you said, that Georgia game was just strange after such an impressive performance. But they did get the win, so they'll just move on to their SEC slate and hopefully be more impressive. The rest of the top 10, though, we saw plenty of beatdowns. Alabama, Florida State, Ohio State, Michigan, Houston, Washington, Wisconsin. They all had pretty impressive beatdowns of either FCS or Group of Five opponents. Whose performances do you think were notable and what impressed you?
Well, I'm going to point out the ones that actually didn't impress me as much as they should have. I mean, Nick Saban already showed the world that he wasn't happy with Alabama's performance, but they did beat the spread, so I think a lot of people underrate Western Kentucky. And the defense did well for most of the game until the end when they were given a short field. But I expected Alabama to beat Western Kentucky, especially after what they did to USC last week. I expected Alabama to beat Western Kentucky by much more. Houston, Greg Ward Jr. set out, but putting up the zero and the whatever was 93 or 97 yards, the defense against Lamar was actually a little impressive. It's hard to impress against the FCS team because it's basically name your score. If the team's not one of the top FCS teams and you're a good Power 5 team, or in Houston's case, as good as most Power 5 teams. Putting up only 42 without Greg Ward Jr., the number's a little low, but again, it's near your score. So the difference between 42 and 70 is just when you pull your starters. Florida State, Ohio State, Michigan, they beat teams down the way we expected. Washington also. Wisconsin's defense, again, was a little impressive. I think Akron, Terry Bowden's done an incredible job in Akron. And I think that Akron's going to be a decent team this year, actually. A decent relative term, but a decent MAC team this year. And we'll see. We'll be able to judge Akron better. The next two games are Marshall and Appalachian State, actually. So, but I think Akron's going to surprise a few teams, and I think if we look back on the end of the season, beating Akron 54-10 is going to look quite a bit better than we think it is now, because Akron's probably good for 7 or 8 wins this year.
Yeah, the one game of those that I want to point out is the Ohio State win. They beat Tulsa 48-3, and I think that's quite impressive just because Oklahoma last year, they almost took down Oklahoma last year in the early season, so it's just impressive to see Ohio State not even give them a chance. Although I think that one last year was in Tulsa, so maybe that was a bit of a factor. And the final item of business is two unfortunate ACC injuries we had this weekend. Derwin James, the Florida State defensive back, has what looks like a potentially bad knee injury. The diagnosis has not come in yet, but people are speculating bad things. And then Hunter Renfro, the Clemson wide receiver, is out at least 4 weeks with a broken hand. Does this affect your thoughts on either of these teams going forward?
James affects me less because when you're that good, right, it's not like there are very few positions in college football, quarterback being the most notable exception, and kicker might also be, but we don't think of it that way, where the drop-off between the best and the next man up is going to be that huge. Without James, Florida's state secondary might be a little worse. You'll see in little things here and there, but like if one player makes a major impact, right, like that means your depth chart's not good enough to compete at that stage anyway, really. Because again, right, he's not the only man in the secondary. He's not playing on an island every play, right? So there are plays where he's going to be sitting out. So without him, right, Florida State's got to have next man up, who's obviously not as good otherwise. He'd be starting in James's place, but that shouldn't make a huge difference. Renfro is an excellent wide receiver. He's clearly Deshaun Watson's favorite target. So without Renfro in the game, I mean, again, right, the next man up, the wide receiver also, should not be significantly worse than the starter. That's just how it works, right? That's just the talent disparity that you're going to see in teams at this level. So there shouldn't be a huge difference. But I would be concerned just how that will affect Watson's rhythm. I'd be more concerned because how it'll affect Watson's confidence in who he wants to throw to and how, because Renfro was clearly his favorite target. And I mean, missing four games, at least four games, and that might not include Florida State, so he might be back by then. We won't really know for a while, but he's probably missing the Louisville game, so that could be big. Well, I don't know, Louisville's defense hasn't been tested yet, so we don't quite know how good their secondary is. But if the secondary looks good against Florida State, then not having Renfro against Louisville might be concerning for Clemson.
Yeah, just the question for Renfro, I think, is whether he is back for that Florida State game or not. And then the Derwin James injury, I think it's a little bit more meaningful than you do. I'm not saying that it's going to kind of kill them, but I tend to think he's probably one of their top one or two defenders, and he was big replacing some lost talent from a year ago, so it'll be interesting to see if they can rebound from that. And as we close this podcast out, just two final questions. Who was the team that you were most impressed by that we already talked about, or maybe one that is a little off the radar?
Most impressed by you on this week or for the season so far?
Just this week.
Just this week. I was impressed. We didn't mention them, but I will say it because I have to mention it. It's going to sound silly, but you guys got to hear me after the whole thing. I was impressed by LSU. LSU in the first half looked horrible against Jacksonville State. Jacksonville State's an FCS team. They're a very good FCS team, probably better than a lot of the FBS cupcakes that teams will play this time of year. So it's not a nothing game. The offense is solid. Move the ball okay against LSU's defense. The defense did a great job stopping LSU and Brandon Harris just like Wisconsin did the week before. And then LSU changed quarterbacks. And once Danny Etling came in the game, right, it's a transfer from Purdue, I think, it was just a different team. And it was an LSU team that looked like they would definitely beat Wisconsin. It just opened up the offense so much more. The offense had choices even without Leonard Fournette. It moved the ball and looked like a team that would have beaten Wisconsin a week ago. It looked like a team that looked like a real threat in the SEC. So LSU in the second half against Jacksonville State, when they pulled Brandon Harris and had Danny Etling quarterback, looked again like a team that looked like a team that should have started out in the top five and not like they looked last week.
The Danny Etling thing kind of is interesting to me just in the fact that he did complete under 50% of his passes, and there have been mixed reviews saying he's going to kind of open up the offense a lot, and others saying that he was less than was not that impressive. But it'll be interesting to see him with Fournette back in the backfield this week against a tougher Mississippi State defense.
Right. He was 6 for 14, and it was just looking at his stats by themselves don't look impressive. But if you saw the game, the difference in how the offense moved was night versus day.
Yeah.
I don't have the yards per play stat in front of me, but it had to have increased at least fivefold between after he came in at quarterback. It was just a huge difference in how the offense performed.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't because of him being a better passer as an option. Maybe it was just because of how the team. Because it lit a fire under the team having the quarterback pulls or something like that, but the offense just looked so much more efficient with him back there. It looked like an offense that could compete in the SEC.
I think he certainly added some verticality to that offense just because Brandon Harris would just kind of throw it side to side, and he gave the dynamic playmakers that LSU has some chances to actually make plays, which is nice to see after plenty of stagnant play. And finally, who's your top five following week two?
My top five? I won't give you a particular order. Well, I'll give you Alabama number one. After that, 2 through 5, there's not a lot to separate them just because we haven't seen so much from them. But as of right now, I got to put Houston in there. That win over Oklahoma, which was not as close to the final score, was very impressive. Ohio State and Michigan look like monstrous talent, and Florida State looks very talented. They've got a dynamic, mobile quarterback. Defense looked strong after, they finally got on track against Ole Miss. But once they got on track, they haven't looked back. So those are my top five with no particular order for 2 through 5. It's Alabama number one. Then I've got Houston, Ohio State, Michigan, and Florida State.
Well, so much for suspense. Those five teams are the same as mine. Alabama number one, and the other four I did have tough times sorting, but I think I wouldn't say definitive, I guess, but I do think that those are the top the most impressive teams we've seen so far. That's your week two preview for the college football season. Not the best slate, but there was certainly some interesting football throughout the country. You can follow me at @A_Craycraft on Twitter. Yesh, what's your Twitter handle?
YESH222.
Simple enough. I'm excited for week three. It's right around the corner. A slate that rivals week one in terms of its meaningfulness, and I'm ready for it to get going. Also follow Last Word on Sports, College Football at Last Word on CFB, and go check out the new website, Last Word on College Football. We're producing some great content over there throughout the country. And I think that's all we got for you.